Hi, this is Jeff Shapiro, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 28th issue of the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump's China deal may avert a crisis of his own making. The Trump administration is hailing a potential deal that may return the U.S.-China relationship to where it was before the president began a trade war against Beijing. Trump administration officials have hailed the makings of a potential trade deal that could have China buy American soybeans and pause the introduction of its new licensing system on rare earth minerals, while the United States pauses or removes some of its tariffs. It remains to be seen what might be agreed when President Trump meets the Chinese leader Xi Jinping this week. But those and the other measures that U.S. officials have mentioned appear to largely restore the relationship to a status quo from earlier this year, before Mr. Trump began his latest trade war with Beijing. The United States and China have shown their willingness to repeatedly escalate trade tensions and hurt companies that do business across the Pacific before walking back measures and striking a truce. But the truces have quickly crumbled, calling into question how durable a new agreement would be. Speaking on ABC News on Sunday, Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, said American and Chinese negotiators who met in Malaysia over the weekend had, quote, reached a substantial framework, unquote, for the two leaders to discuss when they meet in South Korea on Thursday. He said a 100% increase in United States tariffs on Chinese exports scheduled for November 1st had been averted, and that China had agreed to delay a rare earth licensing system for a year while they re-examine it. The Chinese also agreed to help the United States stop the flow of chemical ingredients used to make illicit fentanyl and make substantial agriculture purchases for the U.S. farmers, Mr. Bessent said. On social media, Brooke Rollins, the Secretary of Agriculture, praised the planned soybean purchases as big news. She added, China's commitment to make substantial purchases of U.S. soybeans brings the market back into balance and secures years of prosperity for American producers. But critics said the Trump administration appeared to be claiming credit for solving a crisis of its own making. China stopped its soybean purchases earlier this year after it put a tariff on American soybeans in retaliation for the tariffs that Mr. Trump had placed on Chinese products in April. The Chinese government had clearly been developing its licensing system for rare earths for some time, and it introduced its first measures in December in response to technology restrictions from the Biden administration. But it greatly enlarged the system following Mr. Trump's sweeping Liberation Day tariffs in April, and then further expanded it this month after the United States put in new restrictions on providing technology to thousands of additional Chinese companies. Paul Triolo, a partner of DGA Albright Stonebridge Group, a consultancy, said that the Trump administration had been pursuing a policy of escalating to de-escalate, which he called a losing strategy. He pointed out that this was the fifth meeting of trade talks that had been dominated by China's curbs on rare earths. Both sides can hurt each other, Mr. Triolo said. All it's done is reduce market share for companies across the board. Mr. Trump's deal-making is famously unpredictable, and his meeting with Mr. Xi could result in other deals. Chinese officials have floated the possibility of more substantial purchases of U.S. products, as well as greater Chinese investment in the United States. In another interview on NBC's Meet the Press, Mr. Bessent said that the two sides would probably discuss more balanced trade, geopolitical relations in the Middle East and Asia, and the conflict in Ukraine. Markets have jumped at the news of a potential deal, but talks have been much less intensive than in Mr. Trump's first term, when negotiators went back and forth for months to hammer out a 90-page trade agreement on issues ranging from intellectual property and banking to agriculture. On Friday, the Trump administration said it was beginning an investigation into China's failure to comply with the terms of that agreement. Jonathan Zinn, a fellow at the Brookings Institution, a Washington think tank, pointed out that Mr. Xi was coming to the meeting after announcing China's next five-year plan, which calls for intensifying the country's focus on manufacturing and technology. Those plans run counter to longstanding American concerns about China's trade practices, which ostensibly started their trade clash, he said, but those topics appeared absent from the agenda. It's really striking to me that not only are they not even discussing it, we're discussing issue at a time, Mr. Zinn said. We're talking about TikTok or about soybeans, these kinds of sectorial or even firm-specific issues, rather than talking about the big, meaty, substantive issues that may have been at the heart of this at the outset. Compared with Mr. Trump's first term, both Washington and Beijing have been more willing to take dramatic actions against each other, to the detriment of companies that depend on the trading relationship. In Mr. Trump's first term trade war with China, he imposed tariffs of up to 25% on just a portion of China's exports. This time, in his first 6 months in office, Mr. Trump put a 20% tariff on all Chinese exports in return for the country's role in channeling fentanyl to the United States. He added another 125% tariff that he later dropped to 10%. The administration has also placed fees on Chinese ships that dock in American harbors, expanded its technology controls, and threatened an additional 100% tariff on Chinese goods as of November 1st. While most foreign governments have not retaliated against Mr. Trump's aggressive trade policy, China has been an exception. Beijing responded to Mr. Trump's measures with its own tariffs on U.S. exports, including soybeans. It also announced investigations into prominent companies based in the United States, like NVIDIA and Qualcomm, and an anti-discrimination probe that could result in actions against American firms in addition to the rare earths curbs. American companies have been caught in the middle. Industry analysts say some factories are weeks away from stopping production if they do not receive more shipments of Chinese rare earth metals and magnets. And some firms worry that conflicting laws and directives from Beijing and Washington prevent them from complying with both. Evan Medeiros, a professor at George Washington University and a senior advisor at the Asia Group, said that Chinese officials believed that they understood that Mr. Trump better than in the first administration and knew how to retaliate more effectively. The willingness of both the United States and China to take aggressive actions against each other was resulting in an inherently unstable situation that could undermine a truce, he said. Both sides are approaching the relationship with confidence. Both sides believe that the other needs them more than they do. And ultimately, both sides believe that they have an upper hand, Mr. Medeiros said. It was, he said, a very, very dangerous place to be. Next article, Trump, long erratic on the world stage, reaches a new level. Whether because of his increasingly mercurial approach or despite it, President Trump has won some foreign policy victories in his second term. The question now is whether he can build on his record. 9 months into his term, President Trump's approach to allies, adversaries, and competitors around the world has proved a strange mix of successes and increasingly frequent and erratic eruptions, whether he's dealing with Canada or China, Venezuela or the Middle East, or the war for control of Ukraine. Without question, Mr. Trump has enjoyed some substantial second-term foreign policy victories. European allies are now on track to spend far more for their own defense than they imagined a year ago, something several presidents have demanded, but Mr. Trump forced. He has intervened to help defuse a number of long-running regional conflicts, even if some of his claimed successes prove temporary. His biggest achievement to date, winning the freedom of the 20 living hostages held by Hamas and a fragile ceasefire in Gaza, required forceful and skillful handling of his reluctant Israeli counterpart. But if anyone expected Mr. Trump to grow into the kind of global statesman that most of his predecessors sought to be remembered as, they have been sorely disappointed. Never known for consistency or niceties, Mr. Trump has only grown more capricious in his conduct of foreign policy, a tendency on full display as he begins to swing through Asia to confront a combative China and allies uncertain of what he wants or how to deal with him. The president has an instinctual feel for countries, vulnerabilities, and pressure points, said Richard Fontaine, the chief executive of the Center for a New American Security and a former advisor to Senator John McCain. This sometimes produces leverage that he uses to produce good ends, which we saw in Europe and Gaza and the Iran strike. But it also has downsides. Not long after a fruitful meeting with Canada's Prime Minister, Mark Carney, Mr. Trump shut down trade talks in a peak on Friday because he didn't like a Canadian television advertisement that featured the true voice of President Ronald Reagan from a 38-year-old radio speech warning of the long-term costs of tariffs. On Saturday, he went further, slapping an additional 10% tariffs on Canadian goods, a move that could cost American consumers billions simply because Mr. Trump was unhappy with the ad, which was created by the Ontario government. He reacted with fury, threats, and sky-high new tariffs this month when China announced new limits on U.S. access to much-needed rare earth minerals. But then he lowered the temperature as he headed to Malaysia on Friday night, telling reporters on Air Force One that both he and President Xi Jinping of China would have to make concessions this week to reach a trade deal. On Sunday, his negotiators announced progress. After campaigning on a platform of avoiding foreign entanglements, he dispatched a virtual armada to the Caribbean to put pressure on Venezuela and apparently seek the ouster of President Nicolas Maduro. He continues to turn up the military heat, dispatching an aircraft carrier to the region in recent days and striking at least 10 boats that he claimed, without disclosing evidence, were carrying drugs. Most legal experts say that the summary killings of civilians, at least 43 are now dead, are without legal justification, but Mr. Trump refuses to provide Congress or the public a clear statement of his goal. And he has so whipsawed on Ukraine that European officials have repeatedly raced to Washington to understand whether Mr. Trump is siding with President Vladimir Putin of Russia or with Ukraine. If your negotiating position is, well, we'll do whatever works, of course you're going to get played. Whipsawed, said Celeste Wallander, a Russia expert who served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security until January. This is what happens when you don't have any grounding positions in a high-stakes international negotiations. You get a constant spiral of strange, changing positions. More than 9 months into his second term, the only thing predictable about Mr. Trump's handling of global affairs is that it would be an unpredictable mix of instinct, grievance, and ego. And there's little evidence that his tantrums, swerves, and reversals are strategic and thought out, as his supporters sometimes insist, rather than the products of impulsivity, mood, and circumstance. Either way, foreign leaders and ambassadors know to remain wary at all times, with one saying the other day that he enters the Oval Office with the kind of caution needed if there were sticks of unexploded dynamite under the couch cushions. As he prepares to meet a new Japanese leader and Mr. Xi, and after he made a strange public plea to the North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-un, to meet him, even though his last diplomacy was followed by a surge in the size of the North's nuclear arsenal, Mr. Trump is at something of a turning point. Can he build on the foreign policy successes he has had? Or will his mercurial nature continue to generate confusion and conflict rather than results? Mr. Trump's blow-up with Canada started as he went into a rage on social media over the Ronald Reagan voiceover. But he also charged that Canada is trying to illegally influence the United States Supreme Court in one of the most important rulings in the history of our country, a reference to a case that the court will be hearing that weighs the legality of some of Mr. Trump's tariff moves. The president now says that he may attend the court session when it hears the case. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Canadian officials say the intent was not to influence the court. It was to remind Republicans that their party had departed from Reagan's beliefs and was ignoring his warnings. But Mr. Trump is not worried about much recently about interfering in another country's judicial process. Less than 2 weeks ago, he stood in the Knesset, Israel's parliament, and in a diversion from an hour-long speech celebrating the hostage release, urged that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu be pardoned in an ongoing criminal case. And he has not dwelled on his decision to impose 50% tariffs on Brazil because it was, in his words, conducting a witch hunt by putting the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, a Trump friend, on trial, charging him with trying to stage a coup to prevent the current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, from taking office in 2022. Then there are the strikes in the Caribbean and the Pacific, which seem likely to accelerate once the Gerald R. Ford carrier group is on station off Venezuela in a few weeks, a move that was ordered on Friday. But while the Pentagon amasses firepower, roughly a seventh of the Navy's active fleet will be near Venezuela when the Ford arrives, the White House will not declare what its strategic objectives are in the buildup. Officials publicly say that the operation is to stop the flow of cocaine and fentanyl, but U.S. officials privately concede that they're part of a larger drive to oust Mr. Maduro, Venezuela's authoritarian leader. And then there's Ukraine, where Mr. Trump has swerved from repeating Russian talking points to floating the idea of giving Ukraine powerful Tomahawk missiles, only to change his mind. In July, just before meeting Mr. Putin in Alaska, Mr. Trump agreed with his European allies that the most vital step was to obtain a ceasefire, so that the guns would be quiet while negotiations finally took place. But as soon as he got to the American airbase in Anchorage, he said he and the Russian leader agreed that what was needed was a full peace agreement. Ceasefires can be broken, he explained. Only a full peace accord would suffice. European leaders rushed to Washington, gathering around the president in the Oval Office to get him back on track. When there was no follow-up negotiation for a peace accord, Mr. Trump declared that he thought it possible that Ukraine could gain back all the land it lost to Russia after the 2022 invasion, arguing that the Russians were in big economic trouble and could not fight. Then he said he was nearly persuaded to give Tomahawks to Ukraine that could reach deep into Russia. But a well-timed phone call from Mr. Putin convinced him that this would lead to escalation with the Russians, and he backed off. When Mr. Zelensky arrived in Washington last week, Mr. Trump insisted that a ceasefire, which he rejected 2 months before, was the only option, freezing the fighting at current lines. Let it be caught the way it is, he said, referring to the parts of the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine that Russia now occupies. In private, he warned Mr. Zelensky that your country will be destroyed over time by Russia, according to a senior Ukrainian official, the opposite of what he had said a few weeks before. The meeting with Mr. Putin that the president said would happen in Budapest in a few weeks disappeared, leading the president to impose his first sanctions on Russian oil exports. White House officials hailed it as a significant moment. It was the first time Mr. Trump had added to the thousands of sanctions imposed on Russia after its invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. But they declined to say what had changed since the spring when Mr. Trump exempted Russia from most of his tariffs. The driving force of this roller coaster, said Ivo Dalder, a former U.S. ambassador to NATO, is the president's desire to be seen as the one who ends the war. He doesn't care how it ends or with what consequences, only that it ends and supports his claim to a Nobel Peace Prize. How the firebombing of his home changed Josh Shapiro. In an interview, the Pennsylvania governor offered his most detailed accounting yet of the April attack and how he's grappling with its aftermath. 6 months after an arsonist firebombed the Pennsylvania governor's residence on Passover, Governor Josh Shapiro is preparing to welcome back guests for the Jewish holiday of Sukkot. As staff members assembled the buffet, roasted salmon, pumpkin cheesecake, elaborate squared squash dishes in the state dining room, there were few visual reminders of the Molotov cocktails that tore through there in April as the Shapiros slept upstairs, other than a display case containing charred plates, cups, and a Passover Haggadah that survived the assault. But as Mr. Shapiro, a Democrat, sat in his private office to offer his most detailed accounting yet of the attack and its aftermath, he was thinking about the less visible consequences of that night. "The hardest part of me has been in navigating this as a dad," Mr. Shapiro said in a wide-ranging, hour-long interview in which he was by turns defiant and vulnerable. "Grappling with the sort of personal guilt that your job put your kids in a position where they could have been harmed." Sitting down, just down the hallway from the window the assailant smashed to enter the residence, Mr. Shapiro said political violence leaves behind emotional scars, and I think we're working through that as a family. Like many other elected officials, Mr. Shapiro, one of America's most prominent Jewish Democrats, a finalist in Kamala Harris's vice presidential search, potentially a future presidential candidate himself, has long known that life in the public eye carries personal risk. He saw that while serving as Pennsylvania's Attorney General, a role that he held when 11 people were murdered at a Pittsburgh synagogue 7 years ago on Monday. He experienced it while running for governor, when his opponent invoked his children's Jewish day school in what was widely seen as an anti-Semitic dog whistle. Pennsylvania is where President Trump was shot during a 2024 rally, and where Luigi Mangione, accused of assassinating UnitedHealthcare's chief executive, was apprehended. But as common as political violence has become, Mr. Shapiro knows it can feel abstract. He is now advising others who have been touched by political violence and potential candidates who worry about the risks. He's also warning the country with increasing urgency not to grow numb. "Those risks just felt very theoretical to me," Mr. Shapiro said recently. "Sadly, this made it all real." Just before sunset on April 12th, Mr. Shapiro offered Passover greetings on social media and included a photograph of a table set for the holiday meal at the governor's residence. It was not unusual for Mr. Shapiro, a popular governor who faces re-election next year, to offer a glimpse into his religious observance. His first television ad in his 2022 race for governor featured his family celebrating the Shabbat because, he said at the time, "family and faith ground me." He led the Seder, joined by friends and family, including three of his four children, who range in age from 14 to 23, as well as Mr. Shapiro's siblings and their young families. By 2 a.m., the room where they had celebrated was on fire. According to law enforcement officials, a man named Cody Baumer had climbed over an iron fence and darted onto the property. He shattered one window with a small sledgehammer, hurled a Molotov cocktail into the residence, and then smashed another window to enter the state dining room. Mr. Baumer, who wanted to bludgeon Mr. Shapiro with the hammer, cited what the governor wants to do to the Palestinian people, according to a police search warrant. It was unclear what Mr. Baumer, who has a lengthy history of mental illness, was referencing. Mr. Shapiro, who welcomed news of the ceasefire and hostage release deal and backs a two-state solution for Israelis and Palestinians, has been criticized by Palestinian rights activists as excessively harsh toward campus protesters and too sympathetic to Israel. Only a set of thick double doors, which the assailant struggled to open as smoke filled the room, separated Mr. Baumer from the private offices of Mr. Shapiro and his wife, Lori, and their living quarters beyond. He set another fire on his way out. Awoken by yelling and then a state trooper pounding on his door, the governor, his family, and their two dogs evacuated into the chilly night. Within an hour, Mr. Shapiro said he was informed that the fire was a targeted attack. "All I was focused on was making sure my family was safe, because whoever did this was obviously still out there," Mr. Shapiro said, "and figuring out a way as a dad, together with Lori, to explain this to our children." After dropping his family off at their private home in suburban Philadelphia, Mr. Shapiro returned to the governor's residence in Harrisburg by Sunday afternoon, taking in security briefings as the authorities investigated. Mr. Bomber was apprehended later that day. This type of violence is not okay, Mr. Shapiro said at a news conference that afternoon, his voice rising after he stopped to collect himself. This kind of violence is becoming far too common in our society, and I don't give a darn if it's coming from me, from one particular side or the other. After he drove to his sister's house outside Philadelphia, two doors down from his own, to observe the second night of Passover, on the way Mr. Shapiro called his brother to turn over the role of leading the Seder, the ritual retelling of the Passover story. I said to him, "You got to lead this one. I can't. I'm not sure I can do that right now," he recalled. But the governor and his wife were adamant that the holiday go on. So the family, clad in sweatpants and reaching for folding chairs and paper plates in his sister's dining room, held an impromptu dinner. The attack had left Mr. Shapiro shaken up but determined, said State Representative Dan Frankel of Pittsburgh, who has known Mr. Shapiro for two decades. And Mr. Frankel said he rapidly realized that the incident would resonate beyond Pennsylvania. Within days of the attack, Mr. Shapiro was back in public. The Shapiros brought lunch to a Harrisburg fire station, working with the celebrity chef Robert Irvine. They took comfort, they said, in prayers from Pennsylvanians of all faiths, and he stressed his trust in law enforcement. Privately, he was navigating his family's healing and his own. "It doesn't just happen one day, and the next day you go back to how things work," Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, who was the target of a kidnapping plot, said in a telephone interview, but she added, "I don't get a sense that he is deterred." Still, some observers thought that the ordeal would cause even Mr. Shapiro, an ambitious and self-assured politician, to reconsider life on the national stage. "He would not be a human being if it didn't," Representative James E. Clyburn, the influential South Carolina Democrat, told the New York Times in May. Mr. Shapiro acknowledged that his family had discussed whether elected office was worth it. "What I've said is, if I leave because violence pushed us out or scared us, then those who want to perpetuate political violence win," he said. "I've got to stay, and I've got to show that we're not afraid." He did not seek therapy, he said, instead processing the attack through walks with his wife, who has been his best friend since ninth grade. Their biggest concern was helping their children cope. Over the summer, with reconstruction underway at the residence and new security measures in place, the whole family, including his grown children, decided to spend a night there. Both sets of grandparents joined for Shabbat dinner. Mr. Shapiro tossed a baseball around with one son, while another occupied himself with a lacrosse net. Mr. Shapiro was nervous about how everyone would sleep. "It felt really normal, and we just kind of went upstairs to the living quarters, and everybody went to their rooms and just kind of did their normal routines," he said. But as they would be reminded frequently in the following months, little is normal in this political climate. "It's gotten hotter and hotter," Ms. Whitmer said, "and more dangerous." You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Mr. Shapiro quickly understood that the attack on his residence was not an isolated incident, recalled Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota, discussing their shared concerns about the rising political temperature. 2 months later, Mr. Shapiro reached out to Mr. Walz after Melissa Hortman, a former speaker of the Minnesota House, and her husband were assassinated. Since the attack, Mr. Shapiro said he has had many conversations with elected leaders and others thinking about public office. "Knowing that as you're doing that work that I consider to be noble, that it comes with a risk to you and your family," he said, "that's a tension that is a challenge to work through. It is one of the reasons why I'm so motivated to speak out against political violence," he added, "to try and take the temperature down so that good people want to serve." He tells other politicians to speak openly with their children and to lean on security experts. And he said that he can now offer more personal guidance to victims of political violence after experiencing it himself. He often calls fellow governors when political violence strikes in their states and encourages officials to be attentive to their emotional needs. "Suppressing it doesn't make you a tough guy," Mr. Shapiro said. It was not a given that Mr. Shapiro would reach that conclusion. The governor, a practiced politician who has not lost an election since high school, can be a lawyerly, careful communicator, hyper aware of the ways that his words could be misinterpreted. But as political violence has persisted and as he has grown increasingly outspoken, Mr. Shapiro, who has long urged leaders to speak with more clarity in condemning violence, has flashed a less guarded side. He seems to have concluded that unless he's talking about it because it happened to him, people won't necessarily understand the scope of the problem, said former Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania. To Mr. Shapiro, part of that problem is the instinct some have to instantly view acts of violence through their own ideological lenses. President Trump, who mocked Mr. Walz as whacked out following the killing of Ms. Hartman, rather than calling him to offer support, tends to condemn political violence only on one side. That was especially evident after the assassination of Charlie Kirk, the young right-wing activist. Mr. Shapiro, who gave a lengthy speech soon after denouncing political violence, found himself thinking about how brutally difficult the situation must be for Mr. Kirk's young family. At Mr. Kirk's memorial service, Erica Kirk, his widow, sought to bring down the temperature, Mr. Shapiro said. Then the President of the United States got on the stage and talked about the people that he hates. I am hopeful that we can be better, Mr. Shapiro said. He was not blaming Mr. Trump for specific incidents of political violence, he stressed, but added, we're going to have to do it despite the president's conduct. Abigail Jackson, a White House spokeswoman, said in a statement that no one understands the dangers of political violence more than President Trump. Amid rising anti-Semitic violence, the Passover attack on the Shapiros was deeply painful to some American Jews. An attack on our family, said Robert Milgram, whose daughter, Sarah Milgram, who's 26, an employee of the Israeli embassy, was fatally shot in May. For some, it also shook their confidence in the idea that the country was ready for leaders like Mr. Shapiro. About a year before the attack, he told the Times that speaking broadly, absolutely, America could elect a Jewish president in his lifetime. This month, he said his view was unchanged. Being open about my faith has opened me up to be able to have a deeper relationship with the people of Pennsylvania. Allowed them to share their stories, he said, having ushered a reporter into his family's sukkah, decked out in colorful paper chains. We're doing this in this ultimate swing state. Americans, he said, respect faith, even if they don't practice it, and want to have a deep relationship with the people who represent them. On October 14th, Mr. Balmer, who's 38, of Harrisburg, pleaded guilty to charges including attempted murder and aggravated arson. He was sentenced to up to 50 years in prison. Mr. Shapiro told reporters justice was served, but acknowledged that it had been a difficult period. It's especially hard to know that he tried to burn our family to death while we slept, he said. The image of Mr. Balmer roaming the residence haunted him. He did not know if he had eased his children's fears, and theirs was not the only families, he stressed, to experience the consequences of political violence. Time will heal, he said. The scars will remain. Amid a record party investment, two candidates for governor joined forces. Representative Mickey Schirrell of New Jersey and former Representative Abigail Spanberger of Virginia will appear together on Wednesday, hoping to energize Democratic campaign volunteers and voters. The Democratic candidates for governor in New Jersey and Virginia are set to make a rare joint campaign appearance on Wednesday. Representative Mickey Schirrell of New Jersey and former Representative Abigail Spanberger of Virginia will take part in a Zoom organizing rally on Wednesday afternoon put together by the Democratic National Committee. Appearing virtually, so they do not have to leave their respective states in the final week of the election, the candidates will be joined by Democratic Party leaders, including Governor Andy Beshear of Kentucky, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, and Ken Martin, the chairman of the DNC. With 1 week left before the crucial 2025 elections, the DNC is deploying the full weight of our organizing network to contact voters across Virginia and New Jersey, Mr. Martin said in a statement. The stakes couldn't be higher, and our organizing team is ready to meet the moment. The Zoom call is meant to energize Democratic volunteers, but the event will also be streamed on YouTube for the public to view. Virginia and New Jersey are the only states to hold governor's elections in the year following a presidential race like this one. For years, Virginia was considered a more telling indicator of the national mood, having long been a swing state that only recently shifted blue. But this year, the closer election is in deeply blue New Jersey. All recent polling has shown Ms. Sherrill with a small lead or locked in a statistical dead heat with her opponent, Jack Cittarelli, the Republican candidate who is running his third campaign for governor, having lost in 2017 and 2021. The DNC has made record investments in both states, over $3.2 million in New Jersey and roughly that amount in Virginia, according to the party. Candidates from New Jersey and Virginia rarely join forces. The states are very different politically, and races for governor are generally much more locally focused than elections for Congress. But Ms. Sherrill and Ms. Spanberger have a long and intertwined relationship. Both elected amid the Democratic wave in 2018, they were part of a group of first-time female candidates with national security backgrounds who flipped Republican districts. They called themselves the Badasses and formed a bloc of relatively moderate Democrats in Congress. Ms. Sherrill and Ms. Spanberger were roommates while in Washington and still talk regularly. Wednesday's event comes as both states are in the final stretch of their early voting, with both seeing steady turnout indicative of higher voter engagement for the off-year elections. In Trump-friendly Iowa, the president's policies have hit hard. The state has become a stronghold for President Trump. Now his efforts on trade, energy, and immigration are squeezing farmers, disrupting labor, and threatening industries. When President Trump announced the $20 billion bailout for Argentina this month, Larry Ori, 86, a farmer in Earl Ham, Iowa, could hardly believe it, especially after boatwide loads of Argentine soybeans began shipping to China, a once-critical customer for Mr. Orley's family. For Iowans, losing China's soybean market in the president's trade war was only one of many economic shocks that have hit the state since the start of Mr. Trump's second term. The cost of tractors and fertilizers have shot up with his tariffs. Labor has grown scarcer in agribusinesses. Major manufacturers have laid off workers. Even the ubiquitous wind turbines that provide income for some Iowa farmers are in the president's sights. Right now, we're fighting different economic wars all at once, said Summer Orry, 37, the wife of Mr. Orry's grandson, Dan. The couple works in the family's farm business. You can sustain it one at a time, but right now it's death by a thousand paper cuts. Since siding with Barack Obama twice, Iowa has become a stronghold for Mr. Trump. Yet the state has struggled with his economic policies, and during the first quarter of 2025, Iowa's gross domestic product contracted at a 1.2% annual rate. Manufacturing, which drives 17% of Iowa's economic output, has been hit with higher production costs, in part because of steep tariffs on inputs like aluminum and steel. Meatpacking plants, which help make Iowa the nation's leading pork producer, rely heavily on foreign-born workers, hundreds of thousands of whom saw their legal status stripped away by the president. Mr. Trump's war on renewable energy also threatens the wind industry that produces more than half of Iowa's electricity. Some of the state's troubles, like bad weather, high interest rates, an aging and shrinking rural population, and global commodity prices are beyond the president's control. But new economic policies have magnified the state's woes, according to economists, agricultural groups, and some business leaders. This is as challenging as I've seen it, Kirk Leeds, the chief executive of the Iowa Soybean Association, said. We've got uncertainties beyond compare. Next year's midterm elections could indicate how Iowans feel about these policies. At least two competitive House districts will be up for a vote, and the state will also choose a replacement for its retiring governor, Kim Reynolds, and a retiring senator, Joni Ernst. All those posts are held by Republicans. People are hurting everywhere in Iowa, and they're looking for something different, said Josh Turek, a Democratic State House member running from his earned seat. Mr. Trump has argued that the tariffs will help protect American jobs and rectify trade imbalances, while enforcing immigration laws will free up work for citizens. There's no shortage of American minds and hands to grow our labor force, Abigail Jackson, a White House spokeswoman, said, adding that the president was capitalizing on that untapped potential while delivering on our mandate to enforce our immigration laws. And many Iowans remain loyal. Doug Keller, 63, who farms about 15 miles southwest of Waterloo, said that he was hopeful that the president will reach a new trade deal with China that will benefit farmers in the long run. Matt Wyatt, who's 51, who also voted for Mr. Trump, agreed. Money is tighter than it should be, said Mr. Wyatt, who works with Mr. Keller to grow corn and soybeans on close to 1,500 acres of land. But we try to stay optimistic around here. For now, times are tough. Iowa is the country's largest producer of corn and second largest producer of soybeans. America exports as much as half of its soybeans, and the vast majority of that had gone to China, $12.6 billion worth last year. But this year, China stopped purchasing soybeans from the United States to retaliate against Mr. Trump's tariffs. American producers have spent decades working with people in China on how to use soy in animal feed, part of an effort to build up that growing market. Mr. Leeds said he has traveled to the country 25 times and used dollars paid by Iowa farmers to foster strong bonds with Chinese importers. I'm not exactly sure how we repair some of those relationships, Mr. Leeds said. The president's bailout of his ally, President Javier Milei of Argentina, has rankled many Iowans. Since China moved immediately after it was announced to lock up Argentine soybean exports to fill the gap from Beijing's boycott of American soy. Who are you subsidizing, our competitors or us? Larry Ory asked. Iowa's large beef industry then recoiled after Mr. Trump suggested that he would try to lower the cost of beef by importing more from Argentina. Brian Whaley, the chief executive of the Iowa Cattlemen's Association, said Mr. Trump's comments roiled cattle markets and a volatile market provides less of an opportunity for our producers, cattlemen and women here in Iowa, to make decisions that are going to keep them profitable and viable. The president said he will take some money raised by his tariffs and give it to farmers as a bailout, but that's not necessarily welcome news. We would much rather farm with no federal assistance whatsoever, Mr. Wyatt said. We want to be able to sell our products for a good value, and normally we can. John Gilbert, a farmer in Iowa Falls, said he expected the government payments to favor larger agribusinesses and to drive more consolidation in an industry that has been dominated by big corporations. The payments are skewed to the bigger guys, said Mr. Gilbert, a Democrat whose family has about 800 acres of land for grains and livestock. Growers are also contending with tariff-induced price increases on seeds and fertilizer, some of which is imported from Russia and Canada. Prices for nonammonium phosphate, a fertilizer with both nitrogen and phosphorus, are up 14%, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. As he deals with those higher prices, Aaron Lehman, a fifth-generation farmer in rural Polk County, said that he will continue to use his more than 25-year-old Warn Combine. A machine with greater power and a more sophisticated GPS system would cost upward of $100,000 used and more than $250,000 new, he said. Mr. Lehman wondered whether his 26-year-old son could realistically earn a living working full-time on the family farm. Our farms and lots of farms are having to assess if there's real opportunity for years down the road, said Mr. Lehman, who serves as president of the Iowa Farmers Union. The economic pain has spread beyond agriculture to truckers who transport seeds and grains, agronomists who help farmers innovate, and the Main Street restaurants where farmers eat and drink. Everywhere you turn, people are asking, how are you going to make it? Ms. Ory said. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Dan Ory, who's 37, her husband called it just the perfect storm. John Deere, a leading manufacturing and employer that makes agricultural equipment has laid off hundreds of workers from its Iowa factories this year as sales decline and tariffs on steel and aluminum cost the company more than $300 million. Employment in Iowa's food manufacturing is down too. Peter Orazam, an economics professor at Iowa State University, linked that to the layoffs of migrant workers. JBS Foods, a Brazilian meat packer, laid off approximately 200 workers from Haiti, Cuba, El Salvador, and Honduras at a plant at Arumwa in June, said Paulina Atsuguara, vice president for the local chapter of LULAC, a Hispanic civil rights organization. It's not costless to replace that number of workers, Dr. Orozem added. He added that it was difficult to find domestic workers who take these jobs. In Waterloo, some Haitian workers lost jobs at a Tyson pork processing plant, said Yvette Florima, a community outreach coordinator for World Grace Project, which helps refugees and other new migrants in Waterloo find employment. Workers had received letters from the Department of Homeland Security telling them that their legal immigration status would be terminated and they should leave the country, he said. Tricia McLaughlin, Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security, said that humanitarian parole programs undercut American workers and allowed poorly vetted people into the country. JBS employs more than 5,000 people at four production facilities in Iowa. According to Nikki Richardson, a spokeswoman for the company, two more plants are under construction and expected to create close to 1,000 additional jobs in Iowa, she added. We're focused on hiring team members who are legally authorized to work in the United States and will continue to follow the guidance provided to us by the U.S. government, she said in an email. Tyson did not respond to requests for comment. Iowa has a long history of welcoming immigrants. In the 70s, Robert D. Ray, a former Iowa governor, accepted thousands of refugees from Southeast Asia who were displaced after the Vietnam War. The state continued to bring in refugees and ranked 13th in the country for refugee arrivals per capita, according to a 2023 report. Other immigrants are drawn to Iowa's quiet towns and factory jobs, said Alondra Escobar, the lead organizer for Escuela Mi Voz, an immigrant-led advocacy group based in Iowa City. Immigration and Customs Enforcement does not appear to have conducted workplace raids in Iowa this year, but fear has permeated several cities, according to church leaders and some local officials. At La Pasita, a Hispanic grocery store, Taqueria, and meat market in Waterloo, business has declined by 25% over the past 3 months, the owner, Manuel Carrillo, who's 48, said. Iowa's renewable energy sector is also facing uncertainty, driven by what appears to be the president's personal animus toward wind power. The Trump administration and Congress have cut funding for major renewable projects, phased out renewable energy tax credits, and issued new rules to make it harder for some projects to qualify for those credits. The impacts might be modest in Iowa, according to Steve Geyer, a senior lawyer at Iowa Environmental Council, because the state has already heavily invested in wind energy. Still, he said the new rules must be navigated while tariffs raise the cost of new turbines. A correction was made on October 27, 2025. An earlier version of this article included an outdated figure for the change in Iowa's economic output in the first quarter of 2025. According to a revised estimate by the Bureau of Economic Analysts, it contracted at a 1.2% annual rate in the quarter. The Bureau's initial estimate was a 6.1% contraction. In a shift in relationship with Netanyahu, Trump says, "I will decide what is right for Israel." Since an Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal came into effect, the U.S. effort to sustain it appears to have constrained Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The parade of Trump administration officials to Jerusalem over the past week to ensure Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sticks to the ceasefire in Gaza drew a catchy shorthand in the Israeli news media, playing on the Prime Minister's nickname, Bibi Sitting. Beyond the supposed adult supervision being given to a sovereign ally, however, was a more striking change. A distinct new phase in the U.S.-Israel relationship is being cemented, particularly in the relationship between the two countries' leaders. In President Trump's first term, he showered Mr. Netanyahu with political gifts, including recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital and recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Early in his current term, too, Mr. Trump indulged Mr. Netanyahu, briefly feeding right-wing Israelis fantasies of depopulating and developing the Gaza Strip as a Middle Eastern Riviera. He then backed Mr. Netanyahu in March when he broke a ceasefire with Hamas, and he delivered an entirely new level of support to Israel by deploying B-2 bombers to strike Iran's nuclear sites in June. The term used in Israel was that he works for us. Reuven Hazan, a professor of political science at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, said of Mr. Trump, everybody thought that Trump was mouthing words that Bibi wrote for him. That is no longer the case. Rather, Mr. Trump has increasingly aired his frustrations with Mr. Netanyahu. One earlier example was Mr. Trump's eruption at the prime minister over an Israeli airstrike on Iran in June, after a ceasefire had been reached in that 12-day war. After Israel's botched airstrike on Hamas negotiators in Qatar last month, Mr. Trump, meeting with Mr. Netanyahu in the Oval Office, forced him to call the Qatari prime minister and apologize. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, elaborated in a 60 Minutes interview on October 20th. I think he felt like the Israelis were getting a little bit out of control in what they were doing, he said, and then it was time to be very strong and stop them from doing things that he felt were not in their long-term interests. It was an extraordinary revelation by Mr. Kushner, who indicated that Mr. Trump believed that he was acting in Israel's interests and that Mr. Netanyahu was not. Mr. Trump went on to push Mr. Netanyahu into agreeing to his Gaza peace plan, including an acknowledgement of Palestinian aspirations to statehood, which the Israeli leader adamantly opposes. A day later, Mr. Trump told Axios, he's got to be fine with it. He has no choice. With me, you got to be fine. For all his talk toward Mr. Netanyahu, Mr. Trump and his aides remained supportive of Israel, as he demonstrated abundantly on his trip to Jerusalem this month. And he continues to threaten Hamas with harsh actions if it fails to meet its commitment to return all the bodies of Israelis. Though in a social media post on Saturday, he made it clear that other countries would be the ones to take action against Hamas if it did not comply. Israelis have begun to question how long the United States will keep up the pressure if Mr. Trump shows signs of losing interest. He doesn't have staying power, Mr. Hazan said. He can't continue to be the Bibi sitter, and he can't continue having people flying in. The question is, who will break first? The president hasn't just asserted his dominance over Mr. Netanyahu in relation to Gaza. Mr. Trump told reporters in mid-October that when it comes to a potential two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians, I will decide what I think is right. And in an interview with Time magazine, Mr. Trump was asked whether he believed Marwan Barghouti, a popular Palestinian figure convicted in 2004 on terrorism charges for his role in attacks that killed 5 people, should be released from Israeli prison. Mr. Barghouti was not among the 250 Palestinian prisoners serving long sentences whom Israeli released in a trade for hostages held in Gaza. Mr. Trump said that he had just been discussing the idea of releasing Mr. Barghouti, adding, I'll be making a decision. I, he said again, not we. Mr. Trump has also rejected in increasingly emphatic terms the idea that Israel would annex parts of the occupied West Bank. This is a long-standing goal of Mr. Netanyahu's right-wing coalition partners, and one that has gained support since a host of countries recognized Palestinian statehood last month. It will not happen, Mr. Trump said in the Time interview. Israel would lose all of its support from the United States if that happened. The U.S. effort to sustain the truce in Gaza appears to have constrained Mr. Netanyahu as well. On the ground, Israeli officials are accustomed themselves to a new arrangement in which U.S. counterparts appear to be taking a more assertive role in maintaining the ceasefire. When Israel threatened to stop all humanitarian aid from entering Gaza after 2 of its soldiers were killed on October 19th, The order was reversed within hours and trucks carried aid into Gaza the next day. Israeli news media attributed the reversal to U.S. intervention. The details of that arrangement are taking shape at a new civil-military coordination center set up by about 200 U.S. military personnel in Kiryat Gat in southern Israel. Both Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio toured the center last week. U.S. military officials said that the center would monitor the fulfillment of the ceasefire agreement and help facilitate the flow of humanitarian, logistical, and security assistance from international counterparts in Gaza. The United States has even begun operating drones over Gaza, suggesting that officials want to have their own understanding, independent of Israel's, of what is happening. It is all quite a bit for Israelis to process. It was not so long ago that Mr. Netanyahu plastered giant campaign billboards on skyscrapers in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, showing his face along with Mr. Trump's, with a slogan proclaiming him in another league. Now, Mr. Netanyahu appears diminished in stature next to the president, Mr. Hazan said, like the governor of a state rather than the leader of a country. A survey by Israeli public broadcaster on Sunday found that 48% of Israelis believed Israel has become a U.S. protectorate. Only 29% disagreed. In remarks to his cabinet on Sunday, Mr. Netanyahu felt compelled to address the issue head-on. Israel is an independent country, he said, repeating himself moments later, that he had to say so twice was his own admission. It's a far cry from the days when Netanyahu seemed to reveal in his battles with American presidents and often won them. He defied President Biden, saying Israelis would fight with our fingernails if Mr. Biden cut off arms shipments. He defied President Obama by addressing Congress to denounce Mr. Obama's nuclear deal with Iran. And he enraged President Clinton so much that Mr. Clinton asked him in horribly salty terms just whose country was the superpower. Israel is heading into an election year, though the date of the vote is not yet known. Mr. Trump has reputedly been the bearer of very generous gifts to Mr. Netanyahu before his election campaigns. But Mr. Trump is now making clear that he could also pose a threat to the prime minister. If Mr. Netanyahu's political weakness, Mr. Trump's outsized popularity among Israeli voters, and Mr. Trump's drive for a peace agreement all endure, might Mr. Netanyahu conclude that the key to his political survival is not blocking a Palestinian state, but making one possible? You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times, October 28th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Jeff Shapiro. Thank you for listening.